I just casually looked towards the canal, and I saw what I thought was a mannequin.
August 2nd, 1998, a brilliant young scientist is found dead near the campus of Georgetown University. The gruesome murder shocked D.C., but she wasn't the killer's only victim.
He jumped into the door with a blanket.
Unknown Subject, Season 3 of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, follows one man's gruesome 9-year crime spree and detectives' never-ending pursuit to find him. I'm Paul Wagner, host of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, available October 4th on all podcast platforms.
Previously on 22 Hours, an American Nightmare.
When I heard that this had happened, the first thing I said to my husband when he called me was, "Oh my God, I saw Amy yesterday. I saw her."
Okay, Jack, let's talk about how we put this timeline together. This is all from court testimony.
And some other kinds of evidence, like cell phone records.
Hey, Nelly, it's Sava. I hope you get this message. Amy is in bed sick tonight.
It is being called a major crime scene as homicide investigators examine a house that caught fire in Northwest D.C.
The room is a crime scene.
They found four people, including a child, dead inside on the second floor.
Right now, it does not appear that this was just a random crime.
I said, "But what happened?" They said, "We don't know. They killed the whole family."
Police have said they believe more than one person is responsible for the crime.
A wide-reaching manhunt for Darren Wendt, stretching all the way to New York City.
We had the DNA on a piece of crust. How did his DNA get into that house?
Got a package that I'm going to need you to bring down to me.
To do what he did to four people, including a 10-year-old boy, is just beyond words.
They were brutalized, and we saw the evidence of that.
The jury has just reached a verdict in the murder trial of Darren Wendt.
He was going to strike the American dream just by committing murder and mayhem.
This is 22 Hours, an American Nightmare. A quick note before we start. If you haven't listened to episodes 1 or 2 yet, stop, go back, and listen to those first. This episode will make a lot more sense if you do. And a heads up, this episode contains some explicit language. It's Thursday, May 14th, 2015. Light breaks just a few minutes after 6 in the morning. It has now been 15 hours since an intruder entered a lavish home on the corner of 32nd Street and Woodland Drive in Northwest Washington, D.C., and took Sava and Amy Savopoulos, their 10-year-old son Philip, and Vera Figueroa, one of the family's housekeepers, hostage. In the last episode, we laid out the timeline of that day, the timeline of phone calls and voicemails the family made while they were being held hostage. In this episode, we're going to lay out the timeline of how it ended, the family and Vera's last hours inside that house on Woodland Drive. One of the things that's difficult to get over, just difficult to imagine, is that long night while they were being held, probably the longest night the Savopoulos family and Vera Figueroa have ever experienced. It's hard to put yourself in their place. Was there ever a point when sheer exhaustion took over and they nodded off, even just for a brief moment? And when they woke up, did they think, if only for a second, it was all just a bad dream, a nightmare? As the sun rises, the calls start up again from inside the house on Woodland Drive. At 6:19 in the morning, Amy Savopoulos' phone is used to make a series of calls to a man named Eric Pellick, the vice president of SEI Security. His company had recently installed the Savopoulos' security system. 45 minutes later, at 7:02 a.m., Amy's phone again calls Eric Pellick. It's unclear from the call logs we saw during the trial if they actually got through. We also don't know who was actually dialing. It was Amy under duress, Sava using her phone, or someone else. But no matter who it was, it's clear from the frequency of the calls, they're desperately trying to reach the security company well before business hours. And those aren't the first calls the families tried to make to the security company. The calls actually started the night before. At 10:08 p.m. on Wednesday night, the night the family and Vera were taken captive, Sava makes his first call to Eric Pellick's number. He wanted to know how his home's new security system worked. Were the cameras outside the house always recording, or was there something that would cause them to activate? And where was the video stored? Was it saved in the cloud? Meaning, was it stored on the internet somewhere? where someone else could find it and watch it? When they finally connect that night, Eric Pellick tells Sava he believes the security cameras are set to record when they detect motion, and the footage from the Savopoulos home was not being stored in the cloud. It was saved directly to the hard drive of a computer, which was inside the house, in a utility room on the third floor. But why then? What triggered Sava to start making those calls on Wednesday night? It all goes back to the pizza. Investigators believe the intruder who had taken the Savopoulos family and Vera hostage, who had forced them to order him pizza, stepped out on their front porch that night to pick it up and noticed a security camera pointing right at him. We should be clear, that's the prosecutor's theory of what happened. There's no hard evidence or video of him picking up the pizza from the front porch because the computer hard drive where the security camera footage was stored was stolen from the house. It was never found. Whatever video it recorded of who went in and out of the house and when remains a mystery to this day. But the prosecutor's theory makes a lot of sense when you lay out the timeline like this. Less than an hour after the call to Domino's Pizza, the family starts calling their security company with a flurry of questions about the footage. Pellick says it's normal to get a few follow-up calls with the new system, but not that many, and not at that time of night. And then, for some reason, the next morning, the calls to the security company start back up again. Sava has more questions. Is there anything stored in the cloud? And he also wants to know how he can access the recorded video. We don't know why they called over and over again. Maybe the kidnapper forced them to call back with more questions. Maybe they were trying to reassure him he wasn't captured on the security camera. And even if he was, he could take that footage with him. He could still get away. It's hard to explain why all those calls to Eric Pellick didn't throw up any red flags. He did work for a security company, after all. Pellick said later the repeated calls did seem strange. A few months before, he'd gone out to the Savopoulos home to meet with the family and oversee the installation, and he'd explained to them then how the security system worked. But Pellick said, despite all those calls, he didn't suspect what was really going on. Sava sounded normal on the phone. In between all those calls to the security company, the timeline also shows a plan being put into motion to get the ransom delivered to the house. It's not like Sava just called up the bank and immediately had thousands of dollars dropped off. There were a series of calls that morning to several people about getting this money, including one call to his assistant, Jordan Wallace. Sava talks to Jordan on the phone, telling him to go to the office and wait for a package. American Ironworks is in Hyattsville, Maryland, just over the D.C. line. Sava doesn't say what the package is, but that it will be ready at about 10 a.m. When he talked to him on the phone, he passed along the same message he left on Jordan's voicemail the night before.
Hey, Jordan, it's Sava. Time to change your voicemail. It still says you're at Autobahn. Slight change of plans tomorrow. Instead of going out to Chantilly and helping me put that that thing together, would you please go straight to the Hyattsville office and wait? I've got a package that I'm going to need you to bring down to me. Then
phone records show Sava calls his sister, Deborah Masser, again. When he talked to her the day before, Sava said he needed anywhere between $35,000 and $50,000. This morning, when he talks to his sister, he has a specific amount, $40,000, and he wants it dropped off at his house. Debbie tells him she'll reach out to Ted Chase, the company's chief financial officer. After getting off the phone with Debbie, Sava calls Bank of America directly. It's barely 8 o'clock in the morning, but he catches Elena Shepherd as she's arriving in the office at the branch in suburban Maryland. Elena Shepherd knew Sava. She'd worked with his account for years. American Ironworks was in her portfolio of clients. Part of her job was to make sure he was happy. In fact, his company was one of her top five clients. On the phone that morning, Sava tells Elena he wants to make a withdrawal, $40,000 in cash. Sava would frequently use bank financing or a loan to purchase expensive equipment at daily auctions. But Elena says something about the request didn't sit right with her. It wasn't necessarily the amount of money. It was that he wanted it all in cash. But she quickly put it out of her mind. It wasn't her place to tell a client what to do with their money, and Sava sounded fine. A little rushed, maybe, but fine. She tells him she'll start working on it. She'll have to call around to a few different branches to see which one has the cash on hand. After talking to the bank, Sava calls Ted Chase, American Ironworks CFO, to tell him he needs the money picked up at the bank. It would be tricky, though. As the CEO, Sava had sole authority to withdraw money. And Sava wasn't going to drive to the office to sign a letter, clearly. He never explained why he wasn't coming in, and neither Debbie nor Ted asked. He was the boss. Sava and Ted decided on the call that Ted would draft a letter, email it to Sava, and then Sava would sign it digitally. Ted would then take that letter, with the digital signature, to the bank. Ted Chase had been working for the company for about 2 years at this point. Sava had never asked him to handle this large of an amount of money before, all in cash. But Ted had also spoken to Sava's sister, Debbie Masser, and she didn't seem alarmed, so neither was he. Later, during the trial, Ted said that Sava sounded perfectly normal on the phone. Nothing out of the ordinary at all. Sava is still holding it together. A little more than an hour after he put the plan into motion, at 8:18 in the morning, Sava gets the email from Ted Chase with the letter for him to digitally sign. A copy of the letter was entered into evidence. It's on American Ironworks' letterhead. To whom it may concern, this shall serve as my authorization to withdraw $40,000 from AIW Inc.'s checking account. Please hand the cash to Ted Chase, our chief financial officer, when he presents this letter. If you would like to contact me to confirm, please call me on my cell phone. Thank you. 4 minutes later, at 8:22 in the morning, Sava replies to Ted's email with a digital signature. Meanwhile, the outside world is starting to stir. Neighbors walk their dogs past the house. Cars roll down the street. Everything's normal, but not inside 3201 Woodland Drive. There's only one person who could have the insight and understanding of the family to know something wasn't right. At 8:30 in the morning, the family's other housekeeper, the woman they've employed for 20 years, Nellie Gutierrez, tries to call Vera. Nellie's sitting in her kitchen in Montgomery County, Maryland, having her coffee and getting ready to head to work at another house she took care of in the suburbs of Virginia. She's thinking about Vera. It wasn't sitting right with Nellie that Vera changed her mind at the last minute and decided not to go to work at the dojo. Instead, she decided to go to the house on Woodland Drive. She also hadn't answered Nellie's call from the night before, so Nellie tried again.
No response, so I said, what's wrong with my friend? So when I sat drinking my coffee and thinking, why I feel this way?
But realizing she had no real reason to worry, other than some missed calls, Nellie tried to make sense of Vera's silence. She knew Vera took Metro each day and figured she was probably underground without any reception.
I thought that she cannot answer her phone because she was riding the Metro. So by 8:50, I said, let me call her. No answer.
Nellie couldn't have known what kind of trouble Vera was in, but it was unusual for Vera to ignore her calls. She hadn't gotten back to Nellie all morning. It was enough to raise concern. Nellie called three times that day. Vera never picked up the phone. Investigators believe Vera was restrained upstairs over those 2 days, alongside Sava, Amy, and Philip. Crime scene photos show Vera's cell phone tucked away inside her purse, two floors down, all the way in the basement, by the laundry where she usually did the ironing. Vera had no chance of answering those calls. Hi guys, Megan here. In addition to 22 Hours, I'm also working on a new podcast for WTOP called The DMV Download. We are taking a deep dive into the biggest, most interesting local stories of the day that are happening around DC. So if you enjoy hearing me here, it's a little bit of a different vibe, but I hope you'll check out The DMV Download. Thanks. Shortly after 9 a.m., Elena Shepherd calls Sava back. She has good news. She tells him the Bank of America branch, just down the street from American Ironworks office in Hyattsville, Maryland, has the $40,000 available to withdraw, meaning the money will soon be on its way to the house on Woodland Drive. A little after 9 a.m., Jordan Wallace, Sava's assistant, gets to the American Ironworks office in Hyattsville. That's early for Jordan, but he knows he has a job to do for his boss. With light traffic, American Ironworks office is about a 30-minute drive from the Savopoulos' house on Woodland Drive. The office is the sprawling, low-slung cinder block building with the company's name stenciled in big blue capital letters across the top of the shop. It's in an industrial area of Prince George's County, Maryland, bordering D.C. The shop is surrounded by glass repair and auto body shops and cheap restaurants, like this hole-in-the-wall diner called Burger Delight, where you can get a hamburger for $3. There's also a Pepsi bottling plant nearby. AIW was founded in 1948. Sava's father, Phil, who made a name for himself in the construction industry in D.C. and in the Baltimore area in the 1960s and 70s, bought the company in the 1980s. In recent years, business was booming. American Ironworks was involved in some of the city's biggest development and construction projects. D.C.'s multi-million dollar city center project had revitalized a large part of downtown, which stood for years as just a giant empty parking lot. AIW also had a hand in building the Capital One Arena downtown and the museum on Pennsylvania Avenue. That morning, when Jordan Wallace gets into the office, he says good morning to everyone. He's sitting there scrolling through the eBay account he ran for Sava when Ted Chase comes up to his desk. Ted tells Jordan, "Follow me." Ted Chase has decided to bring Jordan to the bank with him. Meanwhile, back at the house on Woodland Drive, there are a series of unexpected visitors. Around the same time that Ted and Jordan are meeting up at the office, the Savopoulos' doorbell rings. It's shortly after 9. At the door is a technician from the company that took care of the family's underground lawn sprinklers. It was the technician's first house call of the day. The appointment had been in the books for weeks. But it seemed to him that the Savopoulos' forgot. He's standing there, ringing the doorbell, and no one's coming to the door to answer. We think the sprinkler technician is still there waiting near the front porch when a few minutes later, at 9:12 a.m., the phone of the sprinkler company rings. It's Amy Savopoulos. She speaks to the boss, a man named David Arbor. Amy says she needs to cancel the appointment. She tells him she isn't at home, that she had to leave the house because her son was injured and she had to take him to the hospital. No problem, David Arbor says. He tells his technician to go on to the next appointment and they'll reschedule it later. He was asked during the trial if anything stood out about that call. Yes, he said. Amy sounded nervous, very nervous. Out in Hyattsville, Ted Chase and Jordan drive in separately to the Bank of America. It's just a few blocks away from American Ironworks. Ted Chase says he's decided to bring Jordan with him to the bank because he wanted eyes on the transaction. He's concerned about carrying around that much cash alone because he knows how much money he's picking up. Jordan does not. Yet. We have the surveillance video from inside that Bank of America. There's no sound, but you can see Ted Chase and Jordan Wallace walk in. Ted is wearing a short sleeve, button-down shirt and khakis. He walks up to the counter, places both hands on the counter, and sort of leans in. He has white hair. He's bald on top and wearing glasses. Jordan Wallace sort of hangs behind Ted, holding his hands behind his back. He's wearing a plaid shirt with reddish-pink chinos. And he has these big white plastic sunglasses sitting on top of his head. While the video is a little jerky, the quality is still pretty good. You can see Ted and Jordan chatting as they wait for the teller, who seems to be tapping away at the computer. Jordan takes out his phone and looks to be texting someone. At another point, Ted and Jordan are laughing about something. Then another teller comes over and slides the check across the counter for Ted to sign. He pulls out his ID from his wallet and slips it back across the counter to the teller. Then a few minutes later, the teller hands over neatly wrapped stacks of cash, one at a time. 1, 2, 3, 4. The transaction lasts about 12 minutes. Ted holds up all four stacks, piled one on top of the other. It's $40,000, all in $100 bills. Ted splits them into two stacks. He puts one in his left pocket and the other in his right, and then he and Jordan turn and walk toward the door. Back on Woodland Drive, a few minutes after the sprinkler repair guy drives away, more visitors unexpectedly show up. It's Vera's husband, Bernardo Alfaro, and Bernardo's daughter, Claudia, Vera's stepdaughter. Bernardo usually worked overnights doing maintenance work at a hotel in Bethesda, a well-heeled Maryland suburb about 10 miles north of Woodland Drive. Before he left for work the evening of the 13th, Vera hadn't come home yet, but he thought she was working late at the dojo because that was the plan, so he wasn't concerned. But the next morning, when he came home to an empty house and he couldn't reach Vera on her phone, he knew something wasn't right. Bernardo was instantly overcome with worry. It felt like he needed to do something, but he didn't know what. He called his daughter Claudia to see if she'd heard from Vera, and they agreed they'd go to Woodland Drive together. They parked on a side street near the driveway to 3201 Woodland. Claudia's dad told her to wait in the car, and he walked up to the front porch. Looking around, Claudia noticed a flashy sports car parked on the street and decided to snap a picture and text it to her husband. Claudia didn't know what it was at the time, but her husband would. He's a car guy. It was a blue Porsche 911. That text was sent at 9:34 in the morning. Claudia sent a few more pictures, but the longer she waited, she said she started to feel weird. It was too quiet, she said later during the trial. I had a very bad feeling. Meanwhile, Bernardo had been knocking on the front door for several minutes. No one was answering, but he said he felt like somebody was in the house. He said he heard a little noise inside. That's the way he said it. Almost like someone was moving furniture. Specifically, it sounded like chairs scraping across the floor. Bernardo knocked and waited for what must have been almost 20 minutes. Finally, he gives up and walks back to the car. He leans into the window and tells his daughter, "Someone is in there, and they don't want to answer me." He's getting agitated. He's worried about Vera and considering what to do next. He starts pacing the driveway. Bernardo decides he's going to go back to the house, but as he's walking back up to the front door, his phone rings. It's Sava. There's no voicemail recording to play here because they spoke directly. Sava tells Bernardo he's really sorry. He meant to call last night. He says Amy got really sick and that Vera had gone with her to the hospital. That's why no one was home. Then Sava says he was going to call the hospital and see how long it was going to be, and then he'd call Bernardo back. And he hangs up. Bernardo tries calling back, but Sava doesn't answer. Seeing that her dad was not satisfied with the odd explanation, Claudia suggested they go to the hospital themselves. But Sava didn't mention which hospital they were at. Bernardo is uneasy. Vera didn't speak English very well. Why would she need to go to the hospital with Amy? Sava had reassured him, though, before he hung up the phone. "He told me everything was okay," Bernardo said later. Something we know about the call records from Sava's call to Bernardo, he misdialed Bernardo's number 3 times before he got it right. You have to imagine Vera would have had to dictate the number to whomever was dialing. Maybe it was Sava. Maybe by this point he's just exhausted, or maybe he's getting nervous and is misdialing. Maybe for the first time, he's struggling to hold it together. Meanwhile, outside the Bank of America in Hyattsville, Maryland, Ted Chase pulls out the 2 big bundles of cash and hands them to Jordan Wallace in the parking lot. He tells him, "Guard this with your life." Jordan pulls out a black backpack and stashes the money inside. Ted Chase heads back to the American Ironworks office down the street, and Jordan sets off for Sava's house on Woodland Drive. He pulls out his phone to give Sava a call to let him know he's on the way. As he grabs his phone, he sees his boss is calling him. It's 9:51 a.m. It's a quick call. "Do me a favor," Sava says. "Call me when you're 10 minutes away and I'll give you further instructions." Jordan said later the $40,000 was the most money he'd ever seen in his life, and his basic reaction was something along the lines of, "Holy crap." But he does something a little strange. When he's alone with the money, he opens up the bag, takes out his phone, and snaps a picture, texting it to his girlfriend. Then he deletes the text. A few minutes after Jordan talked with Sava on the phone about dropping off the money, Amy texts Nellie. Why? We don't really know. Nellie wasn't supposed to be at the house that day, but maybe they were worried that she might take it upon herself to stop by. They didn't want any more unexpected visitors, and they knew Nellie had a key. Amy sends a text at 9:56 in the morning. "I'm making sure that you do not come today," she texts Nellie. "If you could come from or Monday, that would be great." That's the exact wording of the text message. Seems like she's trying to say Friday or Monday. Nellie doesn't respond right away. Around the same time, Sava gets a text message from his daughter, Katerina. Away at boarding school, she had texted him the day before about asking a boy to prom. "Is it worth me even asking permission for going to an after prom?" she texted. There's no response. It's haunting because we know all the chaos that was going on that morning, of Sava trying to hold it together, doing whatever it takes, giving in to every demand to save his family. And here's the silly little message from a daughter who had no idea the horrifying ordeal her mother, father, and little brother were going through at that exact moment. This message, a little memento of their normal, happy life, seems out of place given what we know was going on in the house. Now the hostages wait for Jordan and the money to arrive. At 10:15 in the morning, Jordan calls Sava. He's 10 minutes away from the house. Sava tells Jordan he's on an important conference call, so don't knock on the door or anything. Just leave the package on the driver's seat of the car in the garage, inside the flashy red Mosler sports car. Then head to the dojo in Chantilly. "I'll be behind you," Sava tells him. When Jordan gets to Woodland Drive a few minutes later, he parks on the street across from the driveway. He says the right side of the two-car garage door is already open. Before he dropped off the money in the red sports car, Jordan took it out of his backpack and put it in a manila envelope that he'd brought with him from the office. He said he was trying to make it look official. He goes into the garage and opens the Mosler's driver's side door. I don't know if you've ever seen one of these things, but it's a high-end sports car, so the door opens upward, almost like wings. But Jordan knew how to open it. He's driven this car before, back when he used to work at Audubon. Sava let him take the car out once. He said he could hardly enjoy it. He was so nervous he'd ding the Mosler, a hand-built American supercar, reportedly only three ever made, and worth an estimated $700,000. But this time, Jordan isn't getting in the driver's seat. He's placing $40,000 cash on it. It's quiet. Jordan says he never hears anything strange or anything at all when he's inside the garage. "Nothing seemed off," he said during the trial. He heads back to his car. Now it's 10:26 in the morning, and he sends Sava a text message. "Package delivered." Then he turns on the engine of his BMW and pulls away. When he's still in the neighborhood, Jordan gives a quick glance to his phone. It looks like Sava is typing a reply. Those little wiggling iPhone dots appear. But then the dots go away. Just a few minutes after Jordan leaves the house at 10:38, Nellie responds to Amy's text message from earlier that morning. "Hi, Amy. I don't have any plans to go over there today. Monday is fine. Thank you." The money is dropped off, and Nellie apparently has no plans to come by. No one else is expected at the house, and there will be no more calls or texts from that day. At this point, things seemingly go quiet, but it's a deceptive kind of quiet. We have no idea what's going on inside the house, but we know how it all ends. This silence is just horrifying and empty at the same time. This is when we think they were killed. What we know about those 22 hours doesn't stop here. There are two pieces of evidence that reveal what happens next. The first, another one of those rabbit holes in this case. At 11:54 in the morning, almost an hour and a half after Jordan dropped off the cash, Sava's phone pings off a cell tower in DuPont Circle, another D.C. neighborhood closer to downtown. It's about a 10-minute ride from Woodland Drive. If his phone is pinging somewhere else in D.C., it's clear someone else must have taken his phone with them. The second piece of evidence here involves the man investigators say is responsible for this terrible crime, Darren Wint. Shortly after noon, two employees who worked at the residence of the Australian ambassador reported seeing a man matching Darren Wint's description go into the Savopoulos house. A man who ran the day-to-day operations of the ambassador's house was chatting with a landscaper about lunch plans. When they both saw a man walk up the street from the corner and approach the Savopoulos' garage, they saw he had dreadlocks, said he was wearing one of those drawstring backpacks, and then they saw him slip inside. Again, that's a little after noon, about an hour and a half after Jordan dropped off the cash. It's the only time anyone saw Darren Wendt or someone who looked like him near the home over those 2 days. We'll spend more time talking about these pieces of evidence in a later episode. But for now, we'll focus on the end of the timeline, the last few clues that tell us what's going on inside 3201 Woodland Drive. At 1:07 in the afternoon, the Savopoulos' security system alerts to the sound of breaking glass in an upstairs room, and then again in an upstairs hallway. Several minutes later, the carbon monoxide detector goes off in the house. The system alerts to the sound of breaking glass in the living room. Then the smoke detector blares an alarm. Within the next few minutes, neighbors start texting Sava and Amy about the fire. But first, a man driving through the neighborhood, a wallpaper installer named Donald Spence, spots the smoke pouring out of the roof. He jumps out of his truck and runs to the front door.
Hey, I think there's a house fire at 3201 Woodland Drive. Got smoke coming out of the eaves and the window.
It's 1:24 p.m. on May 14th, 2015. Okay. We want to reiterate, this timeline we've laid out for you is, by and large, the timeline advanced by prosecutors. There's a lot of evidence that supports it. We've told you about the call records and voicemails and cell phone pings. And then there are the witnesses. Some you've heard from, Margaret Pressler, who saw Amy out walking. You're going to hear from her again in a minute. We tried to track down some of the others who also testified during Darren Wendt's trial. The sprinkler repair guy who knocked on the door. The woman at the pet resort who persistently called about their reservation, the head of the security company who got Sava's late night and early morning phone calls, and Donald Spence, the wallpaper hanger who spotted the smoke in the first place and called 911. We either didn't hear back from them, or they told us they didn't want to speak with us. Eric Pellick with the security company said, "It was still too sensitive to talk about. I have nothing to say," he told us. "No comment." Ted Chase, the chief financial officer at American Iron Works, who withdrew the $40,000, said he didn't want to participate either. He told me, "I'd really rather not." So we had to move forward without some of the witnesses telling us in their own words. However, we do have their testimony from court records and from our notes throughout the trial. This is the prosecution's timeline based on their witnesses and evidence. And the jury, in convicting Darren Wendt, signed off on it for the most part. But not everything fits. There are gaps. Even the prosecutors agreed there are gaps. The lead prosecutor, Laura Bach, made it very clear to jurors before they were sent back to deliberate, while frustrating, not every detail has to fit to convict Darren Wendt. The burden was on the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Darren Wendt committed the crimes he was charged with. But they did not have to prove how or why, or every little detail of how he carried it out. Problem is, that's not how our brains work. Well, those of us who are not attorneys. It's human nature to want to know the details, to want to fill in those gaps so the timeline makes sense. We should also mention those gaps were highlighted for us by Darren Wendt's defense team. It was part of Wendt's lead public defender, Judy Pipe's strategy, to zero in on those holes in the timeline and keep hammering away at them. How could it be true if it doesn't make sense? Throughout the trial, she raised all these questions about those ill-fitting details or gaps in the timeline, building doubt. In the defense's mind, drawing jurors' attention to the inconsistencies would create reasonable doubt. In the end, though, it wasn't successful. But it did leave us with nagging, gnawing questions about some of the most basic aspects of what happened. For example, did Margaret Pressler really see Amy out walking in the neighborhood before she was taken captive? The defense really tried to raise doubts about the testimony, and the questions have to do with what Margaret said she remembers Amy wearing the afternoon of May 13th.
And so she was kind of dressed up, not fancy, but she was dressed as though she had gone out to lunch or something like that. She looked nice, and she was wearing a white shirt and had a dark cardigan or jacket or something slung over her shoulders, and she was wearing she had a satchel, sort of a leather satchel, kind of a square satchel over her shoulder, and a khaki skirt is what I remember. I mean, I remember it was light, a light colored. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing her shoes. They were, She had slender ankles, and so I remember seeing her ankles and her shoes. Just, you know, you sort of see somebody walk, and you just, you know, that quick moment.
And it's funny what we noticed, too.
But her bag was on her right shoulder, so it was facing me and sort of, you know, blocking a good chunk of her body. But she had her hair up in a slightly messy bun, and which she often did, and she had some pretty strawberry blonde hair, and it was just, you know, it was just Amy walking the way she walked. I mean, she wasn't a rusher. She never rushed. I don't remember seeing Amy walk really fast to do anything. And I guess I noticed that because I'm a rusher. I walk fast everywhere I go. Drives my kids crazy. And she was not like that. So, you know, maybe that's one of the reasons I recognized her gait. But just, you have some friends who you could recognize them down the aisle in a supermarket from the back just because of the way they're walking.
Is there any question in your mind whether it was her?
Oh, no, none whatsoever. Absolutely not. 100%.
But Amy was seen on surveillance video at the doctor's office earlier that morning in a completely different outfit. She was wearing a dark tank top and white pants. And this is important. That's also what she was wearing when firefighters pulled her bloodied body from the upstairs bedroom the next day. If Amy was seen out walking in the neighborhood in one outfit, and prosecutors believe she was taken hostage right as she walked in the front door, remember her bag and the Starbucks cup that was sitting on the bureau right in the foyer? Then how and when would she have had time to change her clothes? The defense made a big deal out of this inconsistency. We asked Margaret Pressler about it when we talked with her.
I don't know what she did or what she wore in the morning or whether she changed or when she changed or whatever. I mean, listen, the defense has to do that, right? They have to find anything they can to, you know, I'm sure they were thrilled when they found that piece of video of her going in the morning, but it doesn't change what I saw and the fact that that's what I saw Amy wearing. And again, I would say to you, this was a moment in time. I did not study her, but, you know, I know it was Amy. I know exactly what time it was. I am telling you what I remember her wearing, and I remember the bag. So, you know, I can't say anything more than that. And that's what I said to them on the stand. Like, I think what really matters is someone who had known Amy well, who recognized her easily and could very clearly say without any doubt that that's who it was, who I saw, and exactly what time it was. Would I have remembered that moment if nothing had ever happened? I'm sure not. Would I have remembered that was one time out of 100 that I saw Amy Savopoulos walking along the street? You know, no. Mm-hmm. But when the next day someone comes to you and says, oh, and she was murdered, you know, that night. And I was like, wait, I saw her just yesterday. And it was like so close. It was so mm-hmm. close in time. It was easy to recall that memory. That memory just was very, very clear to me.
Another tactic the defense used in the trial was to try and cast doubt on Jordan Wallace, Sava's assistant. Now, we should say that it wasn't just Darren Wendt's lawyers who were suspicious of Jordan Wallace. Even the police were suspicious of him at first. Let's go back to May 14th, 2015. When Jordan finds out about the fire, it was a couple hours after he dropped off the money at the house. He's alerted after neighbors see the flames, and there's all these frantic calls from the office trying to figure out where Sava is. Immediately, Jordan is panicked. He feels like he was just there. The call records show he tries to call Sava and Amy repeatedly. He also texts them. Hey, Miss Amy, are you okay? If so, you need to get home. I got a call. Your house is on fire. Another worker at the dojo later said everyone was worried when they heard about the fire, but Jordan was acting like a nervous maniac. Jordan races to Woodland Drive, and when he gets there, police decide to take him in for questioning. They searched his phone. They got a warrant to search his car and take a DNA sample. And they had some reasons why they were suspicious at first. Think about it. Jordan was an easy pick as a suspect early on in the investigation. Jordan was a new employee who didn't know Sava long, just long enough to have his trust and know how his life ran. And he's also the only person the family knew to go near the house while they were being held captive. Meanwhile, Darren Wendt's defense attorneys treated Jordan like he was on trial. They tried to accuse Jordan of bragging about his rich boss on social media, suggesting maybe the wrong people found out who he worked for. They mentioned how Jordan knew the house, had been inside before. He knew where the keys were kept. They made a point of mentioning how, at the time of the murders, Jordan was still trying to pursue his own dream of racing cars, a career that costs thousands of dollars a year. And then look at Jordan's actions the day he dropped off the money, the day of the fire. The photo he took of the money he sent to his girlfriend. He texted, "My job is insane. Don't show anyone." His girlfriend responded, "WTF." And then almost immediately after sending those messages, Jordan deleted them. Why? When police find the deleted text, he tells them he deleted it because he didn't want Sava to find out about it. He said he and Sava sort of had an understanding that Jordan was to be discreet about his boss's wealth, and he felt like it may have crossed a line. No matter the reason, it didn't look good to police. Plus, there were already things Jordan told police that had raised some eyebrows. During the trial, they played parts of the police video when he was first questioned. In it, Jordan is sitting in a small room across the table from a DC police detective. Jordan sounds nervous and a bit defensive. He's wearing the same outfit we saw him in on the bank surveillance video, the red chinos and plaid shirt. It may feel like the bank withdrawal was days earlier, but it had only been a few hours. Police are really interested in the money drop, for obvious reasons. It's becoming clearer it wasn't for Sava to spend at an auction. It was ransom money. And now, knowing four people are dead, and the house where Jordan dropped 40 grand earlier that day is torched, his story is not believable. The detective keeps asking him over and over again how the money drop went down, asking him to go step by step. And Jordan gets tripped up. For example, at first he says when he went to the garage to drop off the package, the red Mosler sports car, the car worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, was locked, and that he had to get the key from the inside cabinet in the garage. In the police video, Jordan even physically reenacts walking over to it, getting the key, and then unlocking the car. But then he backtracks. No, the car was unlocked. When the case came to trial, that's what Jordan said on the stand, that the car was unlocked, that he never went to a cabinet to get the keys. In fact, the keys to the Mosler weren't even kept there. They were kept in a dish on a table inside the house. That wasn't the only inconsistency. Jordan first told police the first time Sava had reached out to him was earlier that morning, even though we've all heard that voicemail Sava left for him the night before. He also told police when Ted Chase handed them the money, it was already inside the manila envelope. It's almost like he was trying to prevent police from finding out he knew that the package he was dropping off was money. When he was asked in court about why his story changed, Jordan told the prosecutor he was confused and scared when he was being questioned by police. He felt like they didn't believe him and they were treating him like a suspect. And if you watch the video, it's clear police are treating him like a suspect. They don't believe him, his story about dropping off the money, or his story about picking up the money. We don't have the audio of this part of the police interview, but they played it during the trial. Later, we got a copy of the transcript. Police are not buying Jordan's story about the trip to the bank at all. I asked Jack to read the transcript so you can hear what they said to Jordan.
The fucking bank is not just going to give you $40,000 and then say, "Hey, you know what? You're a loyal customer. Here, put that shit in your fucking pockets and roll the fuck out."
They were practically shouting at him. But at the time they were questioning Jordan, police didn't have all the call records showing how Sava called to arrange the money drop. Those calls to Ted Chase and Debbie Masser and Elena at the bank. Nor did they have the emails or his digital signature. So one of the main reasons police were suspicious of Jordan turned out to be unfounded. Jordan really did show up to the bank with Ted Chase, and the bank really did hand the money over exactly as he told them. During his opening statements, prosecutor Chris Bruckman was clear. He told jurors, "Jordan Wallace had nothing to do with this." He went on, "Taking that picture of the cash and sending it to his girlfriend? Sure, it was stupid. But Jordan is innocent." Those are powerful and rare words from a prosecutor. People whose job it is to prosecute crimes don't usually issue blanket statements about a person's innocence unless they have solid evidence. And there is plenty of other evidence that clears Jordan Wallace. His whereabouts over the 2 days that the family and Vera were held and then killed are thoroughly accounted for. For example, we go back to when Amy calls Sava the dojo on May 13th, the day they were taken captive. First of all, Jordan is out in Chantilly with Sava at the time. After Sava leaves, investigators were able to track Sava's location back to Woodland Drive using his phone's pings off nearby cell towers. They did the same thing with Jordan Wallace's phone. They tracked Jordan all the way back to his house in Annapolis, Maryland, about an hour east of D.C. When Sava calls him about picking up the package the next day, Jordan's phone is still pinging off the tower in Annapolis. And after Jordan drops off the money, his cell phone pings line up with him driving out to the dojo in Chantilly. Plus, the other workers saw him there and vouched for him. The only time Jordan was at the house on Woodland Drive over those 2 days was when he was dropping off the money, just like his boss asked him to, just like he told police.
The wireless customer you are calling is not available.
We tried tracking Jordan down to talk with us. I called a number that once belonged to him, and we tried reaching out via a Facebook account that doesn't appear to have been updated since 2015. It makes sense why he'd want to drop off the radar. Once investigators began looking into Jordan Wallace, and a search warrant was unsealed revealing they considered him a suspect, local news outlets included his name in their reporting. We did too. But some went even further. They dug through his social media and plastered photos of Jordan on TV, including some racing photos he posted on Facebook. Just a few weeks before the murders, Jordan had attended this big racing event in California that included a meeting with Mazda. He was in talks to maybe get a sponsorship deal from the car maker. But then the murders happened, and with the negative media attention directed at Jordan, the deal fell apart. It looks prettier than it did because it has, I mean, the weeds are growing, but they all have like white flowers.
Yeah, and it's green. I mean, it looks like a little meadow.
As we were putting this podcast together, we decided to go back to Woodland Drive.
You know, we put together our best estimate about what happened based on the call records. And this is what the prosecution's best guess, too, you know. But then even with all of that exhaustive timeline that we put together, we still have those questions. Like, we know Jordan dropped off the money. He sent the text message to Sava. Package delivered, 10:26 a.m. And what happened after that? We don't know. And then that weird thing of Sava's phone pinging off that cell tower in DuPont Circle, which is nowhere near here. And we know he didn't leave the house. We know Sava didn't leave the house.
Yeah, so somebody had his phone and was driving it down past DuPont, which is why it pinged there.
And then, you know, this whole thing, I mean, this whole crime unfolded over 22 hours. And Darren Wendt is only seen at this house one time, an hour before the house goes up into flames.
It's not just Jack and I who have had trouble piecing together this timeline. In the first few days after the killings, police thought the Savopoulos family wasn't taken hostage until about 6 on the evening of May 13th. But that didn't really make sense. Vera usually left the house around 3 p.m., so why would she still have been there at 6? And we know, now, the phone lines were cut much earlier that afternoon. In those early days, police also thought they knew how the intruder got in. On one side of the house, there was a set of French doors. A single window pane was broken out, and there was a boot print near the door handle. Police tried to match that boot print to the firefighters who were there, but when they came up empty-handed, they began to think that boot print and the broken window pane could be signs of a forced entry. They took the entire door off its hinges and hauled it into the evidence unit. A search warrant from May 2015 even included a photo of the boot print. But it didn't take long for that potential lead to fizzle. At a preliminary hearing a few months after the murders, a detective revealed that a firefighter had left that boot print. He was working that day, but was injured and was on leave when police were going around trying to find a match. When the trial rolled around, prosecutors had to level with the jury. They weren't sure how the killer got in. Lead prosecutor Laura Bach told them, "We don't know all the details. You're not going to know all the details. You're not going to know what door he came in." But we talked to someone who thinks she might know the answer to that question. It's Nellie Gutierrez, the family's other longtime housekeeper. After Nelly testified, she kept coming to court, she says, to find answers to some of her own questions and learn what happened to Vera and the family. One day, prosecutors were showing jurors photos from inside the house, how it looked when police got there. Officers took hundreds of pictures of the entire house, even parts of the house that had nothing to do with the crime, so far as we know, like the upstairs rec room and the study. It was when they were showing those pictures that Nelly saw something that probably no one else would have noticed.
You know, the trash can in the kitchen was empty. That was normal that she used to go out and take the trash out. So I don't know if he entered the house when she took the trash out.
We weren't really expecting her to tell us this. So we weren't, I mean, when she was first telling us, I wasn't really picking up, you know, on what she was saying. But, I mean, it really was potentially a major clue as to how Darren Wendt could have got into the Savopoulos house.
And what was interesting about it was they couldn't have asked her that question on the stand because she can't speculate. It wouldn't be entered into evidence because it's just her idea. But she's the only person who knew how that house ran, like as far as the cleaning of it. And so when she was looking at the pictures that were being presented in court, she sees that the trash is empty. Now, anybody else would have seen that photo and thought, okay, so what? But Nelly sees it and it gives her this clue, right? That the trash had been taken out, which is one of the last things she said they did every single day.
In addition to putting the dogs out in the backyard.
So it looks to me like Vera put the dogs in the backyard. So the dog had a chance to peep, so she can put the trash out and get everything ready so when Amy come home, she can leave.
And the garbage cans are right here at the end of the driveway. Mm-hmm. So she probably just flips the garage door switch, carries the trash bags out to the garbage can there. And, you know, she's probably not looking behind her. She's probably done
she's
this.
She's like taking the trash out, going to go right back inside.
I mean, she's done this a million times.
Yeah. So with the dogs outside behind the house, I mean, no one's anticipating what's going to happen. So she's distracted taking the trash out. That's when Nelly thinks Darren Wendt sort of seizes the moment and slips inside the house through the garage.
If those dogs weren't in the backyard, I mean, they might have attacked him if they were just hanging around the house. So it really does seem like he lucked out. But here's the thing about the dogs. They may have been in the backyard when he slipped in, but they didn't stay out there the whole time. We know that because of Donald Spence's 911 call. The first call about the fire at 3201 Woodland Drive, he hears dogs barking inside.
Which floor?
There's a dog in the house.
The top floor?
Yes, the second floor, and I can hear a dog barking in the house.
Okay. You don't know whether anyone injured or not?
I have no idea. I just pulled up.
If the dogs were in the back, and these are dogs that are used to being inside, if you left them out all night, they would have gone crazy. So he had to get them back inside somehow. I mean, the neighbors have been like, what the hell? What's going on?
But Nelly has a theory about that, too.
Maybe he tied Vera first with a little boy. When Amy arrived, he said to her, I don't know, maybe he said to her, okay, bring the dogs and put in the basement. If you don't do this, I will do something. So Amy, she tried to deal with this man and do whatever he asked to. So if Amy moved the dogs, of course the dog can listen to her, but not to him. I remember when we have all these appointments, I used to put the dogs in the cage and we used to take them out because otherwise they can attack you, especially Ginger, because she was so protective about she was very protective dog.
This is Nellie's theory. Like we said, she didn't testify to this on the stand. She couldn't. It's pure speculation. But there is evidence that backs this up. We saw during the trial, they showed this crime scene photo of the doggy door. It leads down into the basement, and it's blocked off with tape, like in this crisscross pattern.
I remember initially seeing that photo in court and thinking that was the door to the outside, to the backyard. But then Nellie confirmed it wasn't. It was the door down to the basement.
So when Donald Spence makes that 911 call and he hears dogs barking inside, they were probably trapped in the basement.
In case you're wondering, the dogs survived the house fire. Local TV cameras caught what looked like neighbors or maybe family members leading the dogs away from the house. The smoke never made it to the basement, so it makes sense if that's where they were. We heard a former dog trainer offered to take Ginger and Bear since they knew him and he had the space. Nellie has spent a lot of time trying to figure out how Darren Wint got into that house and exactly what happened once he did. The one thing she can't get out of her mind is what must have been going through Vera's mind when she encountered a strange man in the house.
Can you believe in her mind she said, well, now because of me, leave the door open in the garage, this man came inside. Remember, she passed away thinking she never thought that he worked for Saba because we never saw that man in the house.
Nellie is haunted by the idea that Vera might have died thinking it was somehow her fault, that her actions gave the intruder the chance to get in. We know Vera had trouble communicating in English, but until we talked to Nellie, we hadn't really considered that Vera might not have understood everything that was happening during those 22 hours on Woodland Drive.
You know, she understands a little bit. She can hear, but maybe she can, you know, misunderstand a lot of things going on. So, I don't know, it broke my heart because I wasn't there for her.
Only Darren Wint knows if Nellie's theory is true. It's unlikely Vera would have opened the door to a man she didn't know, especially with Philip in the house. But it's a theory that makes a lot of sense from someone who knew how that house operated on a daily basis. At the same time they were taking all those photos of the home as they found it, it didn't take long for investigators to find key evidence out in the open. We've already told you this case involved a baseball bat, one with Philip's name on it, that was used to beat the victims. Downstairs, investigators found a second bat. Crime scene photos show the black baseball bat lying on the edge of a beige couch in the formal living room. What was it doing down there? We can't know for certain. But Nellie says Vera was protective of all the Savopoulos children, especially Philip. So if she's alone with Philip in the house, and now she sees this stranger has somehow gotten inside, she's going to try to do something. Nellie also told us that in between the foyer, the kitchen, and the garage sat a small mudroom where Philip's sports equipment was stored, including his Little League bat. And here's what we know from investigators. The bat found in the living room wasn't used in the killings. There was no blood on it. There was no link to the killer. When investigators swabbed it for DNA, they didn't find Darren Wint's DNA on the handle. They found Vera's. Vera tried to fight back. Coming up in the next episode of 22 Hours, An American Nightmare. Another fire miles away from the Savopoulos house yields clues that point to the killer.
It was recovered out on Annapolis Road in Prince George's County, Maryland, and it had been set afire.
And investigators combing through the house on Woodland Drive discover a key piece of evidence in the most unlikely place.
We had the DNA on a piece of grass. We figured out that it was not any of the family members. That particular DNA hit came back to Darren Wint.
This podcast was written and produced by Jack Moore and me, Megan Cloherty. Julia Ziegler is our content advisor. Thanks for listening. If you like the podcast, make sure to subscribe and leave us a review. You can see some of the evidence we mentioned, including the video from the bank, on our website, 22hourspodcast.com. And we want to hear what you think. If you have questions about the timeline, email podcast at WTOP.com or find us on Twitter at 22hourspod. Music for this episode is Haters Hate by Ramon Messam, Beyond the Lows by The Whole Other, available in the YouTube audio library. Call Me and Rhythmic Pulse by Daniel Birch, and Weirder by Drake Stafford, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0 International. 22 Hours, An American Nightmare, is a production of WTOP in Washington, D.C.